Record, unless anyone has any objection. I assume that everyone in the room at some point has been to Kevah Rachel in their lives. That's certainly at the top of the list of tourists visiting Eretz Yisrael, especially with its important implications as a Makom Kadosh, along with Kotel and Maris Machpelah, of course. But I wanted to explore a little bit about that unique place that it has in the collective hearts of Klal Yisrael as a makom tefillah, especially during trying times. But in order to do so, we really have to look back at the history of Kevah Rachel, all the way back to the times of the Pesukim in Tanakh, in order to get a better orientation of how it came to be what it is, and if it really is what it is, perhaps a lesson or two that we can take out from the time we spent looking at this a little more carefully. Okay, so let's start with this week's parsha. When we find the passing of Rachel on the way to Beis Lechem is obviously the impetus for this week's topic. Take a look at number one. So Rachel, after giving birth to Yosef a few years earlier, when she's pregnant for the second time, is experiencing unusual pain during the delivery, and the midwife tells her, "Don't worry, this one is also a boy." Obviously, something good news that Rachel wanted to hear, in order that she could share as much as she's able to in contributing, so to speak, to the 12 shvatim, namely the sons that she would give birth to with Yaakov. So as she's about to be nifteris, she names this newborn baby Ben Oni, and Yaakov gives him a slightly different name, Binyamin. Okay, so now this is pasuk number one that's most relevant to our topic. She dies at that moment in that location. And she's buried. The location given to us is Ephras, Bederch Ephras, on the way to Ephras, also known as Beis Lechem. Okay, so obviously not the Ephrat that we identify with nowadays in the Gush, but a name synonymous with Beis Lechem. Next pasuk Chav, Vayasev Yaakov Matzeva al Kvurasa, he Matzevis Kvuras Rachel ad hayom. After he buries her there on the way to Beis Lechem, He erects a stone, some sort of monument, on the place where she passes away, and that is Matzevas Kvuras Rachel Arayom. This is the Matzeva of Kevah Rachel until this very day. Okay, so a couple things to look at carefully in this pasuk, which when you read it carefully, I think jump out at you. Number one, the fact that we identify the location of Kevah Rachel with Beis Lechem is going to be important later. Keep that in mind. Okay, obviously, the fact that we identify precisely where it is altogether is important, but the fact that we specifically relate it to another place where it wasn't, okay, we don't say how close it was to Yerushalayim, we don't say how close it was to Eilat, okay, to Beis Lechem, so let's keep that in mind. Point number two to keep in mind is the choice of words in this pasuk. Okay, the word for the monument built on Rachel's kever is a matzeva. Okay, matzeva, that choice is important because there certainly are other terms to denote some sort of tomb or monument where someone dies, where someone is buried. In Tanakh, number one is the word tzion. Okay, we find that in Malachim, we find that in Yecheskel, ma tzion halaz, hakever ish, etc. Tzion. So tzion literally means a mark. Okay, so that's another term that we find elsewhere in Tanakh to talk about where someone's buried and how it is demarcated. Interesting, in Chazal we have a third way to refer to the very same thing, a nefesh. A nefesh is often the term used to refer to a marker of someone's kvura. And al pi kabbalah, the significance of that is because even after the person passes away and even after the person is buried, the neshama, the nefesh of that person who passed away, lingers to some extent. It's a question of exactly how long the nefesh remains in the vicinity, but that's one of the significant underpinnings for why the term nefesh is used in the context of describing the location where the person is buried. Okay. So we find Yad Avshalom is an example of that, and Yad Vashem, right? That comes from Pasuk also, and the Haftorah that we read on a Tainus, on a fast day, in Yecheskel, because Venasati Bivesi Uvachomasai Yad Vashem. But it's not clear if that refers to a monument or it's used, because it's not even 100% clear if Avshalom is buried there. So Yad Vashem isn't where the people from who were martyred in the Holocaust are buried. It's how we commemorate it, but it isn't necessarily a burial place per se. But that's important. I think there are. It could be the Radak in Malachim understands that Avshalom is buried in the place known as Yad Avshalom. So, okay, very good. So point number one is the location, point number two is the choice of words, Matseva, and point number three to highlight in these psukim in Bereishis is Ad HaYom HaZeh. What's the significance of labeling this as not just Kever Rachel, but this is Kever Rachel Ad HaYom HaZeh? It's true elsewhere in Tanakh, not too often, but sporadically we find that term used, and obviously there's significance in each place unto itself, but why is it so necessary to say Ad HaYom HaZeh over here, in the context of Kever Rachel? Okay, so those are three questions that Mirz Hashem, I hope we'll come back to as we discuss a little more in depth this section of the parsha. Okay, just to get a little more background, skip source number two for the moment, look at number three. Elsewhere, later in Bereishis, we have a further chronicling of what took place in parshas by Yishlach that we're reading this week, that we just read a few minutes ago. At the time when Yosef goes to visit Yaakov, shortly before Yaakov's passing, he brings Ephraim and Menashe to get brachas. Yaakov requests that Yosef bring his body out of Mitzrayim up to Eretz Yisrael to be buried in Maris HaMachpelah. Ultimately, Yosef agrees and swears that he will fulfill his commitment to his father's dying wish. And in that context, Yaakov diverts the attention of the discussion from his own burial to the burial of Rachel, which was not in Maris HaMachpelah. Vani bevoi mipadan meso lai Rachel beeretz Kanan bederech beod kivras eretz lavo efrasa. Okay, so he describes this burial on the side of the road as he's coming from Padan, meaning as they're on their way back to Eretz Yisrael from Lavan's home after the meeting with Esav. Rachel passes away, and she's buried what is already considered Eretz Kanan, but it is kivras eretz lavo efrasa. So before we knew that she was buried Biderech Efrasa, now a little more specifically, Kivras Eretz Lavo Efrasa. What does that mean? Rashi tells us in the next source, Ani bivoimi padan, ba'afu pi she'eni she'ani matriach alecha loholicheni li kaver Eretz Kanan. Right now, this is on the background of what we mentioned before. Yaakov's asking Yosef to bring his Aron up to Eretz Kanan, and that's not an easy task, and he has to ask special permission from Paro to get away from his job for a little while. Lo kachas isili mechan. It seems almost inappropriate, because I didn't bother, as it were, to be matriach to bring your own mother's body back to where she should have been buried, either in Maris HaMachpelah or again, just the side of the road. Maybe we could have come up with some other place to bury her, which would be more kavodik. Because she died in the way over there, and I didn't bring her to Maris HaMachpelah. And nevertheless, I'm asking you to bring me all the way to Eretz Yisrael. Hold on to that for the moment. Kivras Eretz. Rashi explains, Midas Eretz. It is a measure of a tract of land. Him alpaim amma kemidas tchum Shabbos. Approximately 2,000 amos. Kedivrei Rav Moshe Hadarshan. Okay? Okay, it wasn't so far, right? It was just a little bit outside of Beis Lechem, which itself is not so far from Chevron, where Maris HaMachpelah is. So maybe you'll tell me, you know, it was a rainy day, and that's why I didn't bother going to Chevron. No, Esa Gridhaya, Shards Chalula Menukevus Kikivra. Not the case. It was the right time of year. We could have, and the weather was nice, and we could have taken her to Chevron. Rather, the reason was, Ekbra Sham Lohach Tiafil Beis Lechem Lachnisal Arts. I didn't even bring her to Beis Lechem, which wasn't so far. 2,000 amos is, three quarters of a mile, maybe something like that. V'yadati Sheish B'liv Chalai Taromas. And I understand that you may have a tain on me. You may have a complaint that I should have gone the extra mile, or three quarters of a mile in this case. Avaldat Lachash Al Piyadibur Kvar Tiasham. You should know, wasn't my decision. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Al Pi Adibor, I was told, B'Nevua, Shem, Shetehei, Le'ezer, Le'azara, Le'vaneha, Keshe Yigla, Osam, Nevuzaradim. V'Ovrim Derech Shem, the reason I buried her there, again, based on the commandment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was in order that she should be there to help her sons, her children, when they are exiled after the first temple period, after the destruction of Bayis Rishon, by the Babylonians. V'Ovrim Derech Shem, they're going to pass they're going to pass by Kevar Rachel. So Yatz Rachel al Kivro Bochem Vakeshes Aleim Rachamim. She's going to come out and she's going to cry and she's going to ask Rachamim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu on her children. Shenemar Kol Beramah Nishma Rachel Mevaka Al Baneha. A voice is heard from Ramah. We'll talk about what that means in a little while. Rachel is crying for her children. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Meishiv. And the very next pasuk in Yirmiyah, Hashem, as it were, responds to Rachel, Yesh Chal Fulaseh Nom Hashem Vishavu Banim Ugulam. Don't worry, everything you're doing, there will be payback. There will be a positive result from all the effort and all the emotional expenditure that you are giving on behalf of Klal Yisrael, and ultimately Klal Yisrael will return to their boundaries, to Eretz Yisrael. Interestingly, this is definitely the more famous description of where Rachel is there on the way for members of Klal Yisrael to reach out to her and for her to reach out for them. But the Medrash tells us about something much earlier, also along the same lines, but not mentioned here in the Medrash that Rashi is quoting, which is more at length in number 6. The Medrash tells us, not on the sheets, but elsewhere, the Medrash tells us that when Yosef is being brought by the Yishma'elim, by the merchants, after he's sold by his brothers, on the way down to Mitzrayim, so one of the places that they happen to pass is Kevar Rachel. And when he sees Kevar Rachel, which he recognized when he was sold, he was about 17. And maybe he was about 6 or so, 8, something like that, when he was when his mother passed away. So he recognized the place, and it was certainly known to them, where she was buried. He breaks away from his, I don't know, however they were holding him captive, the Sokrim, the merchants, and he runs over to Kevar Rachel, and he davens for his mother to help him, also on the way to an exile of his own, but really the precursor, the Maisa Avos Simon Labanim, for when Klal Yisrael are exiled in the time of Bais Rishon, Rachel's there for them as well. Okay, so now this is, we'll just look at one more source actually from last week's parasha, number 5, when Yaakov initially encounters Rachel at the well, and he's figuring out who she is, and he asks the people, and finds out that this is Laban's daughter, and who he'd like to marry. So he cries, L'fisha tzafa bruch ha-kodesh ha'ena nechnesa imo l'kvura. Why does he cry? Why is he so overtaken with emotions when he sees her? Rashi explains because he becomes aware of the fact that even though he's going to marry her, he's not going to be buried together with her. And that brings him great pain. But the significance of this Rashi, I think, is that it shows you how much of a pre-calculated situation was really at work with the instructions to have Rachel buried on the side of the road because of what she will ultimately stand for Klal Yisrael and future generations. Okay, now, everything we have seen so far, and as it is certainly the simple reading of the Pesukim we've read so far today, indicates that Kevar Rachel is exactly where we would assume it should be, right outside of Beis Lechem, which if you look on the map, that's exactly where it is. But there are a number of sources, one we've actually seen, we'll revisit that in a moment, that actually point to the fact that maybe Kevar Rachel isn't exactly where we're accustomed to visiting. And we'll start with that Medrash we just read. Again, it was actually Rashi in number 4 who quoted the Medrash in number 6. Again, more at length, Bereishis Rabbah, that tells us that Rachel was buried on the side of the road in order to be there as Klal Yisrael is leaving Eretz Yisrael in exile. Now, who were the people who exiled Klal Yisrael after Bais Rishon? As we said before, it was the Babylonians. It was Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the general, was leading the way. He was the executioner. Now, where is Bavel located on the map in relation to Eretz Yisrael? It's north. It's north, and even though it's not due north, you know, Lebanon, on our maps is immediately north of Eretz Yisrael. Syria also, to the east. But we find repeatedly in Tanakh that Bavel is referred to as the northern one. I think right at the beginning of Sefer Yirmiyah, which is the beginning of the prophecy of the destruction, mitzafon tipatach hara'ah, I think is the lashon of the pasuk, which literally means from the north, the destruction, the evil will open up, will begin, namely the impending invasion of the Babylonians. Okay, so again, there are many references in Tanakh that refer to Bavel as a northern territory in relation to Eretz Yisrael. So if that's the case, so isn't it a little bit strange? If you look at a map today, Kevar Rachel and Beis Lechem are located to the south of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? That's the moving towards the Negev. South of Yerushalayim is where you find Beis Lechem, it's where you find Hebron, and that whole region. Oh, okay, excellent question as well. We'll get to that. Good, very good, very good. Okay, so question number one is that if we're being exiled to the north, to Babel, so the path that you'd imagine you take in order to get there is to the north. Okay, not to the south. You're not going to go around, circle around Eretz Yisrael, around Yerushalayim before you go back up north. Doesn't make any sense. Okay, if she's really on the way to Golis, then it makes more sense to say that she's buried to the north. Okay, we'll get back to your point in a moment. So that's in terms of the Medrash. Something doesn't check out with our pinpointing the location of Kibbutz Rachel near Beis Lechem. Let's look at source number 7, Pasuk in Shmuel. Okay, this is at the beginning of Perek Yud. Just as Shmuel is anointing Shaul to be the first king of Klal Yisrael. Yikach Shmuel espach Hashemen, v'yitzok al Roshov, v'yishakehu, v'yomar halokim ashach l'Hashem al nachlaso l'nagir. Shmuel pours the Shemen HaMishcha, the oil that's meant to anoint him, to designate him as the king. He kisses him, and he says, "Behold, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has chosen you to be the leader, the monarch over his people." The precursor, the prologue to the story is that Shaul is sent by his father to find donkeys that were lost, and he meets up with Shmuel along the way. So Shmuel, after anointing him, tells him that as you leave me, okay, as you go away from where we are right now, you will find two people in Kivuras Rachel. Simple pshat is adjacent to, nearby Kivur Rachel, the Gvul Binyamin, in the territory of. Territory of Binyamin, okay. Also describing that that vicinity, Betzaltzach. And they'll tell you a whole story about how the donkeys were found, and you got to go home to your father because your father's worried about you. He's not worried about the donkeys. Go home and tell him you're okay. So now, I think Orly, yeah, okay. So Orly made the point, which seems evident from this pasuk, that Kibbutz Rachel is located in Gvul Binyamin, in the territory that was divided up in the time of Yeshua and given to Binyamin, which, after all, makes a lot of sense, right? She passed away at the time she gave birth to Binyamin. Binyamin was one of her children, so it makes a lot of sense to say that Kibbutz Rachel was located in Binyamin. However, again, where she's buried, according to our tradition, south of Yerushalayim, Hebron, Beis Lechem area, is actually part of Yehuda's territory, not Binyamin's territory. Binyamin's territory is further to the north, above Yerushalayim, and but where she's buried now, again, to our best knowledge, is actually Yehuda territory. So this pasuk makes it even more difficult. Number 8 and number 9, those are psukim reference in the Medrash we saw before, Kol Barama Nishma, okay? Those psukim and number 9 also has a reference to Shalach Osonu Vuzaran Rava Tabachim in Harama. Rama, again, I translated before as from the heights. Okay, Rama literally means heights. Okay, that's where the name of the neighborhoods Ramot in Yerushalayim get their name. They're actually located in the area adjacent to what we identify nowadays as Rama. Okay, which is where Shmuel was from. Shmuel is referred to in Tanakh as Shmuel HaRamasi, Shmuel HaRamati, because he came from that area known as Rama. If you go, if you look on the hills between Yerushalayim and Ramot nowadays, there's a minaret, a little Islamic tower, which is called by the Arabs Wadi Samuel, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, but something like that, which they identify and some others identify with as Shmuel's kever, because again the association with Ramah, which is in that area. But again, that's also north of Yerushalayim, and it's in the territory of Binyamin, further complicating, again, the location that we have designated Bizman Hazeh as Kibbutz Rachel, in the south, in the territory of Yehuda, not in the territory of Binyamin. Okay, let's look at one more source, number 10. What I've told you so far about sort of moving Kibbutz Rachel to the north, as crazy as that sounds, is a position that's been advanced over the years, I think going back about 150 years for the first time by a French archaeologist, okay, who was trying to revamp our perception of Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael geography. And there was a guy by the name of McAllister, an English researcher, who more recently, I think at the beginning of the 20th century, also tried to put together evidence to that effect, putting Kever Rachel towards the north. But, without getting too academic, that suggestion actually goes way back to the time of the Ramban. Okay, the Ramban spent most of his life in Europe, but at the last few years of his life he spent in Eretz Israel. So a lot of the theories that he came up with from the Psukim, from Chazal, while he was in Europe, he ultimately put to the test when he came to Eretz Israel and checked things out with his own eyes. So he writes as follows in number 10. Kivras Eretz, right? What did we say before? Rashi quoted an explanation. Kivras Eretz refers to a measurement of land, which is approximately 2,000 mil, again, considerably less than a mile, which places Kever Rachel very close to Beis Lechem. He brings another pshat at the beginning of source number 10, Menachem Pirish Lashon Kabir Mahalech Rav, a very great distance, from Beis Lechem. Okay, so that's one, if you take that interpretation, so that obviously opens up the door to not placing Kever Rachel where we place it, Bizman HaZeh. Okay, and then he explains the background to how we arrived at a final decision on explaining the pasuk that we read at the beginning. Zekasati Tchil, that was the interpretation I originally adopted. Va'achshav shezachisi ubasi ani liYerushalayim, Ramban fulfilled his life's dream and he comes to Yerushalayim. Shevach lakel atov ha'meitiv, thank you HaKadosh Baruch Hu for getting me here. Re'isi be'enai she'en min kfuras Rachel Beis Lechem afil mil. He said, I saw with my own eyes, if you look at Beis Lechem, you look at the Kever Rachel, it's very close. So it can't be that the pshat I told you before, that it's that Rachel's buried a great distance from Beis Lechem, can't be true. Rashi, it's a small area of land. And then he goes and talks about the etymology of the word, but again concludes at the end of that paragraph that it must be a small distance. Okay, then the next paragraph he says, the other indications that we referenced before of Ramah as being adjacent, Asher l'Binyamin, Rachok mimenak arba parsos, it's like four parsos away. So again, we're increasing the distance from the northern designation and sustaining and supporting the assertion that we're used to that Rachel is buried to the south of Yerushalayim. Va'arama sher b'har Ephraim rachok mena yoser mishnei yamim, and maybe it's a different Rama where the psukim in Yirmiyah kol b'rama nishma that those psukim are referring to, the other Rama that's 2 days away, so that also can't be the pshat. It's nowhere near Beis Lechem. Akein ani omer shakasev shomer kol b'rama nishma melitzik derech mashal. So he says, you know what? It must be that pasuk kol b'rama nishma must not be talking literally about Rama, the location, either the one in Har Ephraim that's 2 days' travel away, or the one that's four parsos away. Rather, it's a melitza kederech mashal. Bless you. Lemor ki haisa rachal tzo ekis bekol gadol umispeid mar atche nishma hakol me rachal birama. It must be that when we say kol birama nishma, that the voice of Rachel is heard birama. It doesn't mean she's in Rama and we're hearing her cry out from there. It means that wherever she happens to be, namely close to Beis Lechem, her cry is so strong and the sound is so great from that cry that you can hear it miles and miles away in the places known as Rama. But it doesn't mean she's in Rama. It doesn't mean she's buried there. Okay, so he brings another pshat, I believe, right afterwards. The second to last line of the source, he quotes from Re'isil Yonasan Ben Uziel. You see it there? Shumargish bezev amar kol berum alma ishtama. It is the a sound that is heard upon high. That would be the best way to translate it. Some sort of heavenly height, but not literally a place called Rama, according to that pshat either. Okay, and just to jump back to the beginning of that paragraph, Nir be'enai ki kavur Yaakov v'derech v'lochnisu li'ir beis lechem Yehuda ha'kavura sham l'fi shetzav v'broch ha'kodesh beis lechem efrasa yel Yehuda l'ratzal kavur rak b'vul b'na b'nyamin. So why didn't he go that extra few steps to bring her into Beis Lechem? Answers the Ramban that is an officially designated city of Yehuda. So he wanted to bury her close to Binyamin. He couldn't get her exactly in the territory of Binyamin, because that wouldn't have worked out based on, for whatever the consideration was, that's where she died, and perhaps that's where she was to be buried. Or as others suggest, perhaps she died in Binyamin, but she was buried there because, again, for whatever reason, that's where the exiles would pass on the way out of Yerushalayim. But he didn't bring her all the way to Beis Lechem, because that would have officially put her in the territory of Yehuda, and that would have been too far away from the territory of Binyamin, where she, so to speak, belonged. Okay. Now, there's other indications of the fact that Barama might not be a place, but rather means the heights, as you suggested, which if you take a look at the next source, the first section indicates that by the diktuk and the nekudos, Birama as opposed to Barama. Had it been Barama, then it would actually indicate in a place called Rama. But since it's Birama, it just means in the heights. Forgive me for being far from well-versed in the difference between the two from a diktuk standpoint, but that is what the experts say. So that's another support to this notion that Rama doesn't mean the location, which was very far away from where Rachel's buried by our estimation. Okay, but in the second half of that source, Rav Schlesinger quotes a Tosefta, which helps us have a slightly better understanding of the Psukim in Shmuel that we quoted earlier, that also seemed to say, right, what does Shmuel say? Shmuel says, you'll find these people, these two people, at Kever Rachel and in Vul Binyamin. So that does put them to the north, puts Kever Rachel to the north. So how do we understand that? So Chazal already were aware of that kasha, and they said what it means is you will find two people who are currently at Kever Rachel, but by the time you meet up with them, you're going to meet up with them in the Gvul Binyamin, in the territory of Binyamin, not near Kever Rachel. That's where they are now, but that's not where you're going to find them. Okay, so all this is what leads us to the classic understanding of where Kever Rachel is. I want to throw in one more point, which I think is perhaps the most compelling, getting back to the question we asked at the beginning, right? The Pasuk identifies the Makom of Kever Rachel as being close to Beis Lechem, right? So if, in fact, this other assertion was correct, the Ramban's original opinion, and what the archaeologists want to say, so that would mean that, again, she's buried north of Yerushalayim, Beis Lechem is down here. So however far Kivras Eretz is, however far that distance of land actually should be considered, wouldn't it be strange to identify her burial place by the city that's down here when you could have picked a place which is much closer to where she's actually buried? It's natural to say that she's buried near the closest city, Beis Lechem, rather than saying she's buried up here, but we'll tell you how far it is from a city that's quite a distant on the map. So, again, that's another very compelling argument, I think, substantiating our location, traditional location for Kever Rachel. Okay. Now, a couple other things to consider as we go on is that, again, we're used to the picture of Kever Rachel. Had to throw in some pictures. A little bit nostalgic for me because I remember when it did look like that picture in the middle, which I think was taken in the late 70s. I think the first time I was in Kever Rachel was 1988, 89. So it did look like that, and transitioned in the later years to the picture on the right, where they tried to maintain that special Kever Rachel placard that stood right outside the building, and they put it inside in the newly renovated compound. But the reason why the structure of Kever Rachel is important is because if you look historically, it was described by visitors over the years differently in different tekufos. Going back to the 12th century, so there was a traveler known as Rabbi Binyamin, who was the author of a book called Masos Binyamin, and he traveled throughout Eretz Israel, and he identified various holy places, Rabbi Binyamin Mitudela. And he said that when he came to Kever Rachel, what he saw was 11 stones, okay, and on top of it was a little dome, a sort of a dome shape on top of four pillars. Now there is a medrash that tells us that when Yaakov originally buried Rachel, when he originally buried Rachel, so what he did was he all the sons of Yaakov took 11 took stones, one for each shevet, put them there. Obviously, Binyamin was a newborn, couldn't do that himself, and Yaakov is the one who put the 12th stone on top of the other 11 in order to complete the monument. So it's not clear if that Medrash actually exists. We'll get back to that in a little while, I think. However, it was more or less what things looked like if you fast forward in time to 1200 when he was there. Okay, so now, in order to stay faithful to the original subject of the title of the shiur, so paradox or paradox. The reason I wanted to talk about paradox is because there's an interesting tshuva in written by Rav Moshe Feinstein about 30 years ago, which is almost entirely focused on the subject of Kevar Rachel. There's another topic that he sort of brushes upon, which I did bring for you at the end of page 2. It's listed there as number 12, where he talks about the person who asked him various questions was wanted to know about the source of the notion of building a matseva for someone who passes away and building remembrances for people who were killed in the Holocaust. And one thing he asked is how come there was no national fast day, Yom Tshuva V'Tainus, ever declared for those who died in the Holocaust. And I think the way Ramosha is responding to it, the question is not talking about Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah is not a national fast day. It's a national day of commemoration. But we do find other pogroms and other tragedies in history that were instituted, were commemorated with actual days of tshuva and tainus. And the person asked Ramosha why that was never done for the Holocaust as well. So I don't want to go into it too much because just in the interest of time, but he borrows an answer, not borrowing, but he echoes a certain response which Rabbi Berzon told me that he heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik was personally opposed to the institution of Yom HaShoah. There always have been those who didn't think it was the way we should properly mark those who were killed in the Holocaust, or mark the murders of those who were killed in the Holocaust, because of a line that we find in the Kinos that are said on Tisha B'Av, which basically says that Tisha B'Av is the one day of Bechil Doros, an eternal day of tragedy that we're supposed to dedicate towards all the things that take place, all the negative events that take place over the course of history as a result of the Gullus. So that's why the Rav thought that we shouldn't make another day during the year, but rather we should focus our mourning over the tragedy of the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av itself. So I don't know that Rav Moshe was against the whole institution of Yom HaShoah, but what he is saying in the Tshuva is that the reason we don't have an official fast day like we do Tisha B'Av, like some communities used to observe the 20th of Sivan, Esrim B'Sivan, was a day in many parts of Europe that was known as a memorial day for those who were killed during the Chmielnicki uprisings in Poland. The Gzeres Tach V'Tat, they're known as the impetus for the institution of Avarachman, which we say on Shabbos morning before Musaf. So there was a tainus. So he was asked, okay, that's I think the focus of his question. How come there was a national day of tainus, not national, but at least local day of tainus instituted, but not for the Holocaust? So he uses that same rationale and says, in terms of tainus at least, so all the tragedies that result from the from being in Gullus are supposed to be centered upon the Holocaust. What's interesting about other events during history was that they weren't part of, they weren't a result of us being persecuted in the same way that we find, let's say, when it comes to Hitler. Hitler was moving across Europe and wanted to wipe everybody out. When it came to the massacres mentioned before, Gzeres Tach V'Tat, so it was a bunch of revolutionaries and bandits who ganged up on the Jews and killed as many as they could, where, interesting, the government at the time actually, to the best of their ability, tried to protect the Jews. And therefore, it's not subsumed under the same rubric of oh, we're in Gullis, let's mourn all the tragedies that come as a result of the Gullis, but that was sort of an aberration. It was certainly God-sent as well, but doesn't fall under the same category. Okay, just a digression, but because it's mentioned in that same tshuva, I wanted to just bring it to light and take a look at it inside. What Rav Moshe focuses on primarily in the tshuva, the first question that he's asked is, what is the source of the notion, our practice of building a matzeva on the kever of someone who passes away? And initially, what Rav Moshe says is that it must be the psukim that we've read in this week's parsha from Yishlach, where Yaakov builds a matzeva on the kever of Rachel. Now, just as Yaakov explained to Yosef, as we mentioned earlier, that it was all al pi hadibur, it was all based on nevuah. Hashem said, bury her there on the road, even though it doesn't seem like the most logical place to bury her. Obviously, Yaakov, if he wasn't prepared to bring her to Beis Lechem, that was also part of the command, and anything he did must have been part of the command, because it's clear Yosef, Yaakov was following the rules, following his instructions down to a T, so if you put a matzeva there, it must be that that was intended as part of the as part of the nevuah as well. So that, he suggests, might be the source, you know, ad hayom hazeh, why we put a matzeva on a person's grave. But then he rolls back and he says, not so fast. Why? Because we find in mentioned in the Medrash on number six as well, just as a side comment over there, the Chazal tell us, in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Ein osim nafshas letzadikim. Ein osim nafshas letzadikim, divrem hein zechronehem. The Medrash tells us that it's inappropriate to build a monument to memorialize a great person, a tzaddik, Talmud Chacham. Why? Because it's more important for their words and their deeds to be what we remember them for. In a sense, by having a stone and writing words on the stone and saying this is where the person is buried and this is what's intended to help us remember this tzaddik in the future, it almost cheapens the life and accomplishments and legacy of the tzaddik when we pin it down to a headstone. Rather, by publishing their svarim, by repeating their divrei Torah, by telling stories about their chesed and about their mitzvos, that is truly what is the best form of commemoration. And anything less is an affront to their kavod. As an aside, Rav Moshe later in the tshuva says, okay, bottom line, you know, if you walk into a cemetery, we have many rabbanim, many great people, and they all are given these headstones. They're all given a matzeva. So he says it must be that in later years, people in just feeling the tragedy of losing a special person, losing a tzaddik, they felt that they weren't doing enough, and the out of the great tsar that they experienced because of the loss of this individual, they felt they had to do additional commemorations. Besides every other way that we can memorialize the legacy of the tzaddik, we have to put it not on paper, we have to put it on stone as well. So once that became the norm, then to not do that for any tzaddik, any Talmud Chacham, would then be an affront to that person's kavod. And the context that he's talking about is, I think it sounds a little bit strange, but the children of someone who passed away asked, you know, we inherited a lot of money from our parents. Instead of us giving it, you know, building a matzeva, which, okay, let's say costs a couple thousand dollars, okay? So let's take a couple thousand dollars, give it to tzedakah. We'll give it to yeshiva, something which, in a sense, is more productive in the big picture than having this, you know, fancy piece of marble. So Rav Moshe says, no, once the norm has become that proper kavod is to do X, Y, and Z, to memorialize the parents with a headstone, with a matzeva, then that's what we have to do, and anything else becomes an affront. It reminds me of a story. Many of the halachas that one observes when mourning parents are sort of a blend between the laws of Avelis and the laws of Kibbut Avaim. Okay, what's the easiest reflection of that is the difference between the recital of Kaddish when one loses, God forbid, a brother, as opposed to when one loses a parent. So for a brother, a person says Kaddish for 30 days. For a parent, a person says Kaddish for 12 months, or 11 months to be precise, but we'll call it 12 for the moment. So that 11-month difference stems from the obligation to show, Kibbut Avaim, to keep saying Kaddish for many months afterwards, many months beyond what one would do for other relatives. The important point there is that if that's an outgrowth of the requirement that one has to perform kibbud avim even after the passing of a parent, then a parent has the ability to be mochel, to forego that right, just like they're, you know, strictly speaking, the Gemara says you're supposed to stand up for your parents when they walk into the room. So Rav Moshe writes, and others say that bizman is that we assume that parents are mochel, fathers mochel, because they drive the kids crazy every time we walk into the room. We got to stand up for them. Okay, but that's just an illustration of the fact that if a parent has a due right, due privilege, then they're allowed to forego that and say, you know, I'll let it slide. So Rav Schachter's father passed away. It's about 7-8 years ago, something like that. Now, so before he passed away, he told Rav Schachter that you're a public figure. People respect you. People look up to you. They always want to invite you to their chasana, to their simchas. I am mochel. After 30 days, normally a person would not go to a wedding. It's not, you know, their own child or something like that. And even then, there's certain parts of the wedding could be present at. Certain parts of the wedding can't be present at. People are going to invite you to their chasana, even though you would normally stay home for that 11-month period after the first 30 days. I want you to go, because it means so much to the community for you to be there, and for the people making the simple for you to be there. I'm mochel on my kavod. That says something very special about Rav Schachter's father, certainly. But the postscript to the story is, Rav Schachter says that he didn't exercise that right. He didn't go to the weddings. Why? The very same point we mentioned before. Because even though he was off the hook, so to speak, just, you know, for lack of a better term, he knew that if he would show up to those weddings, people would be wondering, hey, I thought Rav Schachter was an avelis, and I thought you're not supposed to be going to a wedding. So he didn't say, Rav Schachter didn't say, and then everyone's going to go and attend weddings when they're not supposed to because they see me doing that, and they don't know the behind-the-scenes story. He said, that itself will be a bizayon to my father because people will think that I'm not properly observing the avelis to commemorate his passing. And because, yes, my father forgave me on that part of the deal, told me to go, but he didn't necessarily, or I should say, this is a bizayon, and a bizayon, even the father can't be mochel on that. Perhaps that's the explanation. But in any case, he said, once the norm is not to attend the weddings, so I have to accept that upon myself also, because people would assume the worst and think that I'm not observing my father's avelos. Okay, so in any case, Rav Moshe rolls back and he says, it can't be that that the matzeva was put there simply for kavod, because that's not what you're supposed to do, certainly in those times, for the kavod of the mace. And what's the proof to that is that Marasa Machpelah, in the time of when the Avos and Imos were actually buried, there was no matzeva there. Everything that's built later on top was, I think, was put there by the Turks, much later, only in the last few hundred years. So he says, therefore, it must be, it's not really achiv midoraisa, but rather anything that we do in putting a matzeva on a kever bizman hazeh is actually, again, just a minhag. That's what people began to do, and as a result, it becomes norm, and therefore, it's required. And he points to a number of examples in Europe where there are many communities, many shtetlach, that didn't have the minhag of putting up a headstone. I believe in Hebron, the ancient community in Hebron, their minhag was not to put up an actual matzeva. And if you want to know where the relative was buried, you had to go to the shamans who had the list, the map of all the plots, and that's how you would identify where the relative was buried. So as a result, it must be Yaakov didn't put it there as a matzeva, as a kavod, and that's all something that we adopted in much later periods. It must be it was put there to always be the marker for kever achel, because li'olam voed, as the Medrash sort of hinted to us, kever achel is intended to be the place where Kal Yisrael comes to daven, comes to seek out rachamim min hashamayim, with Rachel's prayers representing us, so to speak, when we go to daven there. And so important was it to have Rachel as part of our, you know, on our team, that the Torah is essentially, when you go back to the first source, Pasuk says, "Vayatzei v'akom matzeva al kvurasa himatzev es kvurasa Rachel ad hayom." We ask, what's the significance of emphasizing the ad hayom? Why did it have to be to this very day? It's almost as if to suggest a prophecy. The Torah is guaranteeing that there will be a matzeva in Kever Rachel, in the location of Kever Rachel, forever and ever for people to come and visit. If you look now at the Malbim, source number 2, about halfway through, There's a period there, and he says, "Ubezen nivlo matzeva zos miyaser matzeva shosim al hamesim." This is what distinguishes the matzeva of Rachel from all other matzevos. Shinyanim hu lahasher zecher hameshi and nizkar idei matzeva. But mason is guarding the matzeva. Elsewhere, when you put up a matzeva, the point is the source number one, source number two. When you put up a matzeva, the mace is remembered by the matzeva. Apopo haya behepech. It was the opposite. Shematzeva neskaim al zecher olam al yidei hamace. It's Rachel's burial place that ultimately lends significance to the matzeva. V'zeu shamar shehi matzevas kvuras Rachel. Okay, this is a punchline. V'od shashar matzevos. Another distinguishing factor between this and all other matzevos. Ein niskaram rak b'dorahu. Any other matzeva is generally for the, you know, generation or generation afterwards, you know, not too far after the person passes away. Aval matzeva zos aideshi matzevas kvuras Rachel nishra kayemes ad hayom. This matzeva is guaranteed to be there forever and ever. Shebecholdo v'dor yichadshu osa, it will constantly be refurbished. This is almost prophetic, the way the Malbim also sort of reads it into the Pesukim. Not just that it will always be there, but it will be constantly renovated and refurbished. L'man yedu kvuras Rachel. So I wonder, as he finishes off, Omer ki heitzev matzevik dey shetei kayemes arayom ba'achar zayamim, sheitzarech ledas mokim kvuras Rachel, that again, despite the archaeology and whatever other research you want to point to, The promise in the pasuk is that the tradition of Kever Rachel is going to be the one that is the actual Kever Rachel, and to come and introduce a new place that no one ever heard of as being the actual place of Kever Rachel seems almost standing in contradistinction to what the pasuk is promising. Just focus for 1 minute on what the Malbim says about it being renovated. I started to mention a little bit about the different forms in which Kever Rachel took had. The forms it took. You look on page number 3, different pictures. Again, it was the independent stones, the 11 and the 12, in the time of Yaakov perhaps, and the dome, and then the dome was walled off. That was done in order to protect the people davening there. And it was around the time of the Malbim himself, in the mid-1800s, when Moses Montefiore, the great philanthropist, who put a lot of money into to building and supporting those living in Eretz Yisrael. So he refurbished Kever Rachel and gave it the basic structure, what it looks like on page 1, the bottom left, which ultimately, again, morphed into the compound, the fortress that it looks like, Bizman Azeh. Sorry, I don't have a picture of that from the outside. Interestingly enough, the person who pushed Moses Montefiore to redo the Kever and make it so beautiful was his wife, Judith, who herself did not have children. And Rachel was her source of chizik, because Rachel, of course, for almost her entire life, did not have any children, and she encouraged him to redo the complex and make it a beautiful structure. And I believe the edifice built upon Moses Montefiore's kever in England is built to replicate the Kever Rachel that he built during his lifetime. So the Malbim, I don't know if he knew it, but even after Moses Montefiore, over the years it has been again improved again and again and again, especially after 1967 when it came back under Israeli control. And to this very day, if you can go on Wikipedia, there's a picture of 2011 renovations. Doesn't stop. That's a promise that Kever Rachel will always be there, bigger and better, and available and comfortable for us to go to be mespal there, to give chizik to all Klal Yisrael throughout the Golus, and ultimately Rachel cried when we walked out, and Eretz Yisrael will be besimcha when we come back. Transition.